wore on, he went more often alone. His ways were hard and long, and he became somewhat grim to look upon, unless he chanced to smile. And yet he seemed to men worthy of honour, as a king that is in exile, when he did not hide his true shape. For he went in many guises, and won renown under many names. He rode in the host of the Rohirrim, and fought for the Lord of Gondor by land and by sea. And then, in the hour of victory, he passed out of the knowledge of men of the west, and went alone far into the east and deep into the south, exploring the hearts of men, both evil and good, and uncovering the plots and devices of the servants of Sauron. Thus he became at last the most hardy of living men, skilled in their crafts and lore, and was yet more than they, for he was elven wise, and there was a light in his eyes that when they were kindled few could endure. His face was sad and stern, because of the doom that was laid on him, and yet hope dwelt ever in the depths of his heart, from which mirth would arise at times like a spring from the rock. It came to pass that when Aragorn was 49 years of age, he returned from perils on the dark confines of Mordor, where Sauron now dwelt again, and was busy with evil. He was weary, and he wished to go back to Rivendell and rest there for a while, ere he journeyed into the far countries. And on his way he came to the borders of Lorien, and was admitted to the hidden land by the Lady Galadriel. He did not know it, but Arwen Undomiel was also there, dwelling again for a time with the kin of her mother. She was little changed, for the mortal years had passed her by. Yet her face was more grave, and her laughter now seldom was heard. But Aragorn was grown to full stature of body and mind, and Galadriel bade him cast aside his wayworn garment, and she clothed him in silver and white, with a cloak of elven grey and a bright gem on his brow. Then, more than any kind of men, he appeared, and seemed rather an elf lord from the Isles of the West. And thus it was that Arwen first beheld him again after their long parting. And as he came walking towards her, under the trees of Carras Galarthon, laden with flowers of gold, her choice was made and her doom appointed. Then for a season they wandered together in the glades of Lothlorien, until it was time for him to depart. And on the evening of midsummer, Aragorn, Arathorn's son, and Arwen, daughter of Elrond, went to the fair hill, Cerin Amroth, in the midst of the land, and they walked unshod on the undying grass with Elenor and Nifredil about their feet. And there upon that hill they looked east to the shadow and west to the twilight, and they plighted their troth and were glad. And Arwen said, "Dark is the shadow, and yet my heart rejoices, for you, Estelle, shall be among the great whose valour will destroy it." But Aragorn answered, "Alas, I cannot foresee it, and how it may come to pass is hidden from me. Yet with your hope I will hope, and the shadow I utterly reject. But neither, lady, is the twilight for me, for I am mortal, and if you will cleave to me, even star, then the twilight you must also renounce." And she stood then as still as a white tree, looking into the west, and at last she said, "I will cleave to you, Dunedain, and turn from the twilight. Yet there lies the land of my people and the long home of all my kin." She loved her father dearly. When Elrond learned the choice of his daughter, he was silent, though his heart was grieved, and found the doom long feared none the easier to endure. But when Aragorn came again to Rivendell, he called him to him, and he said, "My son, years come when hope will fade, and beyond them little is clear to me, and now a shadow lies between us. Maybe it has been appointed so, that by my loss the kingship of men may be restored. Therefore, though I love you, I say to you, Arwen Undomiel shall not diminish her life's grace for less cause. She shall not be the bride of any man less than the king of both Gondor and Arnor. To me, then, even our victory can bring only sorrow and parting, but to you hope of joy for a while. Alas, my son, I fear that to Arwen the doom of men may seem hard at the ending. So it stood afterwards between Elrond and Aragorn, and they spoke no more of this matter. But Aragorn went forth again to danger and toil. And while the world darkened and fear fell on Middle-earth, as the power of Sauron grew, and the Barad-dûr rose ever taller and stronger, Arwen remained in Rivendell, and when Aragorn was abroad, from afar she watched over him and thought. And in hope she made for him a great and kingly standard, such as only one might display who claimed the lordship of the Númenóreans and the inheritance of Elendil. After a few years, Gilrain took leave of Elrond, and returned to her own people in Eriador, and lived alone, and she seldom saw her son again, for he spent many years in far countries. But on a time, when Aragorn had returned to the north, he came to her, and she said to him before he went, "This is our last parting, Estelle, my son. I am aged by care, even as one of lesser men. And now that it draws near, I cannot face the darkness of our time that gathers upon Middle-earth. I shall leave it soon." Aragorn tried to comfort her, saying, "Yet there may be a light beyond the darkness, and if so, I would have you see it and be glad." But she answered only with this linode, "Onen estel edain, ucheben estel arnim," which means, "I gave hope to the Dunedain. I have kept no hope for myself." And Aragorn went away heavy of heart. Gilrain died before the next spring. Thus the years drew on to the War of the Ring, of which more is told elsewhere. How the means unforeseen was revealed, whereby Sauron might be overthrown, and how hope beyond hope was fulfilled. And it came to pass that in the hour of defeat, Aragorn came up from the sea and unfurled the standard of Arwen in the battle of the fields of Pelennor, and in that day he was first hailed as king. And at last, when all was done, he entered into the inheritance of his fathers and received the crown of Gondor and sceptre of Arnor. And at midsummer, in the year of the fall of Sauron, he took the hand of Arwen Undomiel, and they were wedded in the city of the kings. The third age ended thus in victory and hope, and yet grievous among the sorrows of that age was the parting of Elrond and Arwen, for they were sundered by the sea and by a doom beyond the end of the world. When the great ring was unmade, and the three were shorn of their power, then Elrond grew weary at last, and forsook Middle-earth, never to return. But Arwen became as a mortal woman, and yet it was not her lot to die until all that she had gained was lost. As queen of elves and men she dwelt with Aragorn for 60 years in great glory and bliss. Yet at last he felt the approach of old age, and knew that the span of his life-days was drawing to an end, long though it had been. Then Aragorn said to Arwen, "At last, Lady Evenstar, fairest in this world, and most beloved, my world is fading. Lo, we have gathered, and we have spent, and now the time of payment draws near." Arwen knew well what he intended, and long had foreseen it. Nonetheless she was overborne by her grief. "Would you then, Lord, before your time, leave your people that live by your word?" she said. "Not before my time," he answered. "For if I will not go now, then I must soon go perforce. And Eldarion, our son, is a man full ripe for kingship." Then, going to the house of the kings in the silent street, Aragorn laid him down on the long bed that had been prepared for him. There he said farewell to Eldarion, and gave into his hands the winged crown of Gondor and the sceptre of Arnor. And then all left him save Arwen, and she stood alone by his bed. And for all her wisdom and lineage, she could not forbear to plead with him to stay yet for a while. She was not yet weary of her days, and thus she tasted the bitterness of the mortality that she had taken upon her. "Lady Undomiel," said Aragorn, "the hour is indeed hard, yet it was made even in that day when we met under the white birches in the garden of Elrond, where none now walk, and on the hill of Cerin Amroth, when we forsook both the shadow and the twilight, this doom we accepted. Take counsel with yourself, beloved, and ask whether you would indeed have me wait until I wither and fall from my high seat unmanned and witless. Nay, lady, I am the last of the Númenóreans and the latest king of the Elder Days, and to me has been given not only a span thrice that of men of Middle-earth, but also the grace to go at my will and give back the gift. Now, therefore, I will sleep. I speak no comfort to you, for there is no comfort for such pain within the circles of the world. The uttermost choice is before you, to repent and go to the havens and bear away into the west the memory of our days together that shall there be evergreen, but never more than memory, or else to abide the doom of men. Nay, dear lord," she said, "that choice is long over. There is now no ship that would bear me hence, and I must indeed abide the doom of men, whether I will or nill, the loss and the silence. But I say to you, king of the Númenóreans, not till now have I understood the tale of your people and their fall. As wicked fools I scorned them, but I pity them at last. For if this is indeed, as the Eldar say, the gift of the One to men, it is bitter to receive." "So it seems," he said. "But let us not be overthrown at the final test. Who of old renounced the shadow and the ring? In sorrow we must go, but not in despair. Behold, we are not bound for ever to the circles of the world, and beyond them is more than memory. Farewell." "Estel! Estel!" she cried. And with that, even as he took her hand and kissed it, he fell into sleep. Then a great beauty was revealed in him, so that all who after came there looked on him in wonder, for they saw that the grace of his youth and the valour of his manhood and the wisdom and majesty of his age were blended together. And long there he lay, an image of the splendour of the kings of men in glory undimmed before the breaking of the world. But Arwen went forth from the house, and the light of her eyes was quenched, and it seemed to her people that she had become cold and grey as nightfall in winter that comes without a star. Then she said farewell to Eldarion and to her daughters and to all whom she had loved, and she went out from the city of Minas Tirith and passed away to the land of Lorien and dwelt there alone under the fading trees until winter came. Galadriel had passed away, and Celeborn also was gone, and the land was silent. There at last, when the Malorn leaves were falling, but spring had not yet come, she laid herself to rest upon Cerin Amroth, and there is her green grave, until the world is changed, and all the days of her life are utterly forgotten by men that come after, and Elanor and Nefredil bloom no more east of the sea. Here ends this tale, as it has come to us from the south, and with the passing of Evenstar no more is said in this book of the days of old.
This ends Disc 2.
Part 2. The House of Eol. Eol the Young was lord of the men of Eotheod. That land lay near the sources of Anduin, between the furthest ranges of the Misty Mountains and the northernmost parts of Mirkwood. The Eotheod had moved to those regions in the days of King Eärnil II, from lands in the vales of Anduin, between the Carrock and the Gladden, and they were in origin close akin to the Beornings and the men of the West Eaves of the Forest. The forefathers of Eol claimed descent from kings of Rovanion, whose realm lay beyond Mirkwood before the invasions of the Wainriders, and thus they accounted themselves kinsmen of the kings of Gondor, descended from Eldacar. They loved best the plains, and delighted in horses and in all feats of horsemanship. But there were many men in the middle vales of Anduin in those days, and moreover the shadow of Dol Guldur was lengthening. When, therefore, they heard of the overthrow of the Witch-King, they sought more room in the north, and drove away the remnants of the people of Angmar on the east side of the mountains. But in the days of Leod, father of Eol, they had grown to be a numerous people, and were again somewhat straitened in the land of their home. In the 2510th year of the Third Age, a new peril threatened Gondor. A great host of wild men from the northeast swept over Rovanion, and coming down out of the Brownlands, crossed the Anduin on rafts. At the same time, by chance or design, the Orcs, who at that time, before their war with the dwarves, were in great strength, made a descent from the mountains. The invaders overran Cullenarthen, and Cirion, steward of Gondor, sent north for help, for there had been long friendship between the men of Anduin's Vale and the people of Gondor. But in the valley of the river men were now few and scattered, and slow to render such aid as they could. At last tidings came to Eol of the need of Gondor, and late though it seemed, he set out with a great host of riders. Thus he came to the Battle of the Field of Celebrant, for that was the name of the Greenland that lay between Silverlode and Limblight. There the northern army of Gondor was in peril. Defeated in the wold, and cut off from the south, it had been driven across the Limblight, and was then suddenly assailed by the Orc host, that pressed it towards the Anduin. All hope was lost when, unlooked for, the riders came out of the north and broke upon the rear of the enemy. Then the fortunes of battle were reversed, and the enemy was driven with slaughter over Limblight. Eol led his men in pursuit, and so great was the fear that went before the horsemen of the north that the invaders of the world were also thrown into panic, and the riders hunted them over the plains of Cullenarthen. The people of that region had become few since the plague, and most of those that remained had been slaughtered by the savage Easterlings. Cirion, therefore, in reward for his aid, gave Cullenarthen, between Anduin and Isen, to Eol and his people, and they sent north for their wives and children and their goods and settled in that land. They named it anew the Mark of the Riders, and they called themselves the Eorlingers, but in Gondor their land was called Rohan, and its people the Rohirrim, that is, the Horse Lords. Thus Eol became the first king of the Mark, and he chose for his dwelling a green hill before the feet of the white mountains that were the south wall of his land. There the Rohirrim lived afterwards as free men, under their own kings and laws, but in perpetual alliance with Gondor. Many lords and warriors, and many fair and valiant women, are named in the songs of Rohan that still remember the north. Frumgar, they say, was the name of the chieftain who led his people to Eotheod. Of his son, Fram, they tell that he slew Skarther, the great dragon of Ered Mithrin, and the land had peace from the Longworms afterwards. Thus Fram won great wealth, but was at feud with the dwarves, who claimed the hoard of Skarther. Fram would not yield them a penny, and sent to them instead the teeth of Skarther, made into a necklace, saying, "Jewels such as these you will not match in your treasures, for they are hard to come by." Some say that the dwarves slew Fram for this insult. There was no great love between Eotheod and the dwarves. Leod was the name of Eol's father. He was a tamer of wild horses, for there were many at that time in the land. He captured a white foal, and it grew quickly to a horse strong and fair and proud. No man could tame it. When Leod dared to mount it, it bore him away, and at last threw him, and Leod's head struck a rock, and so he died. He was then only 42 years old, and his son was a youth of 16. Eol vowed that he would avenge his father. He hunted long for the horse, and at last he caught sight of him, and his companions expected that he would try to come within bowshot and kill him. But when they drew near, Eol stood up and called him in a loud voice, "Come hither, Mansbane, and get a new name." To their wonder the horse looked towards Eol, and came and stood before him, and Eol said, "Feilaroff I name you. You loved your freedom, and I do not blame you for that, but now you owe me a great weregild, and you shall surrender your freedom to me until your life's end." Then Eol mounted him, and Feilaroff submitted, and Eol rode him home without bit or bridle, and he rode him in like fashion ever after. The horse understood all that men said, though he would allow no man but Eol to mount him. It was upon Feilaroff that Eol rode to the field of Celebrant, for that horse proved as long-lived as men, and so were his descendants. They were the Mearas, who would bear no one but the king of the Mark or his sons until the time of Shadowfax. Men said of them that Beamer, whom the elder called Orome, must have brought their sire from west over sea. Of the kings of the Mark between Eol and Theoden, most is said of Helm Hammerhand. He was a grim man of great strength. There was at that time a man named Freyka, who claimed descent from King Freyawine, though he had, men said, much Dunlendish blood, and was dark-haired. He grew rich and powerful, having wide lands on either side of the Ardorn. Near its source he made himself a stronghold, and paid little heed to the king. Helm mistrusted him, but called him to his councils, and he came when it pleased him. To one of these councils Freyka rode with many men, and he asked the hand of Helm's daughter for his son, Wulf. But Helm said, "You have grown big since you were last here, but it is mostly fat, I guess." And men laughed at that, for Freyka was wide in the belt. Then Freyka fell in a rage, and reviled the king, and said this at the last, "Old kings that refuse a prophet's staff may fall on their knees." Helm answered, "Come, the marriage of your son is a trifle. Let Helm and Freyka deal with it later. Meanwhile the king and his council have matters of moment to consider." When the council was over, Helm stood up and laid his great hands on Freyka's shoulder, saying, "The king does not permit brawls in his house, but men are freer outside." And he forced Freyka to walk before him out from Edoras into the field. To Freyka's men that came up he said, "Be off. We need no hearers. We are going to speak of a private matter alone. Go and talk to my men." And they looked and saw that the king's men and his friends far outnumbered them, and they drew back. "Now, Dunlending," said the king, "you have only Helm to deal with, alone and unarmed. But you have said much already, and it is my turn to speak. Freyka, your folly has grown with your belly. You talk of a staff. If Helm dislikes a crooked staff that is thrust on him, he breaks it. So." With that he smote Freyka such a blow with his fist that he fell back stunned, and died soon after. Helm then proclaimed Freyka's son and near kin the king's enemies, and they fled, for at once Helm sent many men riding to the west marches. 4 years later, in 2758, great troubles came to Rohan, and no help could be sent from Gondor, for 3 fleets of the corsairs attacked it, and there was war on all its coasts. At the same time, Rohan was again invaded from the east, and the Dunlending, seeing their chance, came over the Isen and down from Isengard. It was soon known that Wulf was their leader. They were in great force, for they were joined by enemies of Gondor that landed in the mouths of Lefnui and Isen. The Rohirrim were defeated, and their land was overrun, and those who were not slain or enslaved fled to the dales of the mountains. Helm was driven back with great loss from the crossings of Isen, and took refuge in the Hornburg and the ravine behind, which was after known as Helm's Deep. There he was besieged. Wulf took Edoras, and sat in Medoseld, and called himself king. There Haleth, Helm's son, fell, last of all, defending the doors. Soon afterwards the long winter began, and Rohan lay under snow for nearly 5 months. Both the Rohirrim and their foes suffered grievously in the cold, and in the dearth that lasted longer. In Helm's Deep there was a great hunger after Yule, and being in despair against the king's counsel, Harmar, his younger son, led men out on a sortie and foray. But they were lost in the snow. Helm grew fierce and gaunt for famine and grief, and the dread of him alone was worth many men in the defence of the Borg. He would go out by himself, clad in white, and stalk like a snow-troll into the camps of his enemies, and slay many men with his hands. It was believed that if he bore no weapon would bite on him. The Dunlendings said that if he could find no food, he ate men. That tale lasted long in Dunland. Helm had a great horn, and soon it was marked that before he sallied forth he would blow a blast upon it that echoed in the deep. And then so great a fear fell on his enemies that instead of gathering to take him or kill him, they fled away down the coombe. One night men heard the horn blowing, but Helm did not return. In the morning there came a sun-gleam, the first for long days, and they saw a white figure standing still on the dyke, alone, for none of the Dunlendings dared come near. There stood Helm, dead as a stone, but his knees were unbent. Yet men said that the horn was still heard at times in the deep, and the wraith of Helm would walk among the foes of Rohan and kill men with fear. Soon after, the winter broke. Then Freyalaf, son of Hild, Helm's sister, came down out of Dunharrow, to which many had fled. And with a small company of desperate men he surprised Wulf in Medoseld and slew him, and regained Edoras. There were great floods after the snows, and the Vale of Entwash became a vast fen. The eastern invaders perished or withdrew, and there came help at last from Gondor, by the roads both east and west of the mountains. Before the year 2759 was ended, the Dunlendings were driven out, even from Isengard, and then Freyalaf became king. Helm was brought from the Hornborg and laid in the ninth mound. Ever after, the white symbol Muna grew there most thickly, so that the mound seemed to be snow-clad. When Freyalaf died, a new line of mounds was begun. The Rohirrim were grievously reduced by war and dearth and loss of cattle and horses, and it was well that no great danger threatened them again for many years, for it was not until the time of King Folkwine that they recovered their former strength. It was at the crowning of Freyalaf that Saruman appeared, bringing gifts, and speaking great praise of the valour of the Rohirrim. All thought him a welcome guest. Soon after, he took up his abode in Isengard. For this, Beren, steward of Gondor, gave him leave, for Gondor still claimed Isengard as a fortress of its realm, and not part of Rohan. Beren also gave into Saruman's keeping the keys of Orthonk. That tower no enemy had been able to harm or to enter. In this way, Saruman began to behave as a lord of men. For at first he held Isengard as a lieutenant of the steward and warden of the tower. But Freyalaf was as glad as Beren to have this so, and to know that Isengard was in the hands of a strong friend. A friend he long seemed, and maybe, in the beginning, he was one in truth. Though afterwards there was little doubt in men's minds that Saruman went to Isengard in hope to find the stone still there, and with the purpose of building up a power of his own. Certainly after the last White Council, in 2953, his designs towards Rohan, though he hid them, were evil. He then took Isengard for his own, and began to make it a place of guarded strength and fear, as though to rival the Barad-dûr. His friends and servants he drew then from all who hated Gondor and Rohan, whether men or other creatures more evil. The Kings of the Mark. First line. The first king was Eorl the Young. He was born in 2485. He was so named because he succeeded his father in youth, and remained yellow-haired and ruddy to the end of his days. These were shortened by a renewed attack of the Easterlings. Eorl fell in battle in the Wold, and the first mound was raised. Felaroth was laid there also. The second king was Brego, born 2512. He drove the enemy out of the Wold, and Rohan was not attacked again for many years. In 2569 he completed the Great Hall of Medoseld. At the feast his son Baldur vowed that he would tread the paths of the dead, and did not return. Brego died of grief the next year. The third king, Aldor the Old, was born in 2544. He was Brego's second son. He became known as the Old, since he lived to a great age, and was king for 75 years. In his time the Rohirrim increased, and drove out or subdued the last of the Dunlendish people that lingered east of Isen. Harrowdale and the other mountain valleys were settled. Of the next three kings little is said, for Rohan had peace and prospered in their time. The fourth king, Freya, was born in 2570. Eldest son, but fourth child of Aldor, he was already old when he became king. The fifth king was Freyawine, born 2594. The sixth, Goldwine, 2619. The seventh king, Deor, was born in 2644. In his time the Dunlendings raided often over the Isen. In 2710 they occupied the deserted ring of Isengard, and could not be dislodged. The eighth king, Gram, was born in 2668. The ninth king, Helm Hammerhand, was born in 2691. At the end of his reign, Rohan suffered great loss by invasion and the long winter. Helm and his sons Harleth and Harmar perished. Freyalaf, Helm's sister son, became king. The second line. This line began with the tenth king, Freyalaf Hildeson, born 2726. In his time, Saruman came to Isengard, from which the Dunlendings had been driven. The Rohirrim at first profited by his friendship in the days of dearth and weakness that followed. The 11th king, Britta, born 2752, was called by his people Leofa, for he was loved by all. He was open-handed and a help to all the needy. In his time there was war with the Orcs that, driven from the north, sought refuges in the White Mountains. When he died it was thought that they had all been hunted out, but it was not so. The 12th king, Walda, born 2780, was king only 9 years. He was slain with all his companions when they were trapped by Orcs, as they rode by mountain paths from Dunharrow. The 13th king, Falker, 2804, was a great hunter, but he vowed to chase no wild beast while there was an Orc left in Rohan. When the last Orc hold was found and destroyed, he went to hunt the great boar of Everholt in the Firion Wood. He died of the tusk wounds that it gave him. The 14th king was Falkwine, born 2830. When he became king, the Rohirrim had recovered their strength. He reconquered the West March between Ardorn and Isen, that Dunlendings had occupied. Rohan had received great help from Gondor in the evil days. When, therefore, he heard that the Haradrim were assailing Gondor with great strength, he sent many men to the help of the steward. He wished to lead them himself, but was dissuaded, and his twin sons, Falkred and Fastred, born 2858, went in his stead. They fell side by side in battle in Ithilien. Turin the Second of Gondor sent to Falkwain a rich weirgild of gold. The 15th king, Fengal, was born in 2870. He was the third son and fourth child of Falkwain. He's not remembered with praise. He was greedy of food and of gold, and at strife with his marshals and with his children. Thengal, his third child and only son, left Rohan when he came to manhood, and lived long in Gondor, and won honour in the service of Turgon. The 16th king, Thengal, was born in 2905. He took no wife until late, but in 2943 he wedded Morwen of Lossarnoch in Gondor, though she was 17 years the younger. She bore him three children in Gondor, of whom Theoden, the second, was his only son. When Fengal died, the Rohirrim recalled him, and he returned unwillingly. But he proved a good and a wise king. Though the speech of Gondor was used in his house, and not all men thought that good. Morwen bore him two more daughters in Rohan, and the last, Theodwin, was the fairest, though she came late, the child of his age. Her brother loved her dearly. It was soon after Thengal's return that Saruman declared himself Lord of Isengard, and began to give trouble to Rohan, encroaching on its borders and supporting its enemies. The 17th king was Theoden, born in 2948. He is called Theoden Ednir in the lore of Rohan, for he fell into a decline under the spells of Saruman, but was healed by Gandalf, and in the last year of his life arose and led his men to victory at the Hornburg, and soon after to the fields of Pelennor, the greatest battle of the age. He fell before the gates of Mundberg. For a while he rested in the land of his birth, among the dead kings of Gondor, but was brought back and laid in the eighth mound of his line at Edoras. Then a new line was begun. The third line. In 2989, Theodwin married Eomund of Eastfold, the chief marshal of the Mark. Her son, Eomer, was born in 2991, and her daughter, Eowyn, in 2995. At that time Sauron had arisen again, and the shadow of Mordor reached out to Rohan. Orcs began to raid in the eastern regions and slay or steal horses. Others also came down from the Misty Mountains, many being great Uruks in the service of Saruman, though it was long before that was suspected. Eomund's chief charge lay in the East Marches, and he was a great lover of horses and hater of orcs. If news came of a raid, he would often ride against them in hot anger, unwarily, and with few men. Thus it came about that he was slain in 3002, for he pursued a small band to the borders of the Emynweald, and was there surprised by a strong force that lay in wait in the rocks. Not long after, Theodwin took sick, and died, to the great grief of the king. Her children he took into his house, calling them son and daughter. He had only one child of his own, Theodred his son, then 24 years old, for the queen Elfhild had died in childbirth, and Theoden did not wed again. Eomer and Eowyn grew up in Edoras, and saw the dark shadow fall on the hall of Theoden. Eomer was like his fathers before him, but Eowyn was slender and tall, with a grace and pride that came to her out of the south from Morwen of Lossarnoch, whom the Rohirrim had called Steelsheen. The third line began with King Eomer Eadig. He was born in 2991. When still young, he became a marshal of the Mark, and was given his father's charge in the East Marches. In the War of the Ring, Theodred fell in battle with Saruman at the crossings of Isen. Therefore, before he died on the fields of the Pelennor, Théoden named Éomer his heir, and called him king. In that day, Éowyn also won renown, for she fought in that battle, riding in disguise, and was known after in the mark as the Lady of the Shield Arm. For her shield arm was broken by the mace of the Witch King, but he was brought to nothing. And thus the words of Glorfindel long before to King Eärnor were fulfilled, that the Witch King would not fall by the hand of man. For it is said in the Songs of the Mark that in this deed Éowyn had the aid of Théoden's esquire, and that he also was not a man but a halfling out of a far country, though Éomer gave him honour in the mark and the name of Holdwine. This Holdwine was none other than Meriadoc the Magnificent, who was master of Buckland. Éomer became a great king, and being young when he succeeded Théoden, he reigned for 65 years, longer than all their kings before him, save Aldor the Old. In the War of the Ring he made the friendship of King Elessar, and of Imrahil of Dol Amroth, and he rode often to Gondor. In the last year of the Third Age he wedded Lothiriel, daughter of Imrahil. Their son, Elfwine the Fair, ruled after him. In Éomer's day in the Mark, men had peace who wished for it, and the people increased both in the dales and the plains, and their horses multiplied. In Gondor the king Elessar now ruled, and in Arnor also. In all the lands of those realms of old he was king, save in Rohan only, for he renewed to Éomer the gift of Cirion, and Éomer took again the oath of Éol. Often he fulfilled it, for though Sauron had passed, the hatreds and evils that he bred had not died, and the king of the West had many enemies to subdue before the white tree could grow in peace. And wherever King Elessar went with war, King Éomer went with him. And beyond the Sea of Rûn, and on the far fields of the south, the thunder of the cavalry of the Mark was heard, and the white horse upon green flew in many winds until Éomer grew old. Part 3. Durin's Folk. Concerning the beginning of the dwarves, strange tales are told, both by the Eldar and by the dwarves themselves. But since these things lie far back beyond our days, little is said of them here. Durin is the name that the dwarves used for the eldest of the seven fathers of their race, and the ancestor of all the kings of the Longbeards. He slept alone, until in the deeps of time, and the awakening of that people, he came to Azan-ul-Zebar, and in the caves above Chelid-Zaram, in the east of the Misty Mountains, he made his dwelling, where afterwards were the mines of Moria, renowned in song. There he lived so long that he was known far and wide as Durin the Deathless. Yet in the end he died before the elder days had passed, and his tomb was in Khazad-dûm, but his line never failed. And 5 times an heir was born in his house, so like to his forefather, that he received the name of Durin. He was indeed held by the dwarves to be the deathless that returned, for they have many strange tales and beliefs concerning themselves and their fate in the world. After the end of the First Age, the power and wealth of Khazad-dûm was much increased, for it was enriched by many people and much lore and craft, when the ancient cities of Nogrod and Belagost in the Blue Mountains were ruined at the breaking of Thangorodrim. The power of Moria endured throughout the Dark Years, and the dominion of Sauron, for though Eregion was destroyed and the gates of Moria were shut, the halls of Khazad-dûm were too deep and strong, and filled with a people too numerous and valiant, for Sauron to conquer from without. Thus its wealth remained long unravished, though its people began to dwindle. It came to pass that in the middle of the Third Age, Durin was again its king, being the sixth of that name. The power of Sauron, servant of Morgoth, was then again growing in the world, though the shadow in the forest that looked towards Moria was not yet known for what it was. All evil things were stirring. The dwarves delved deep at that time, seeking beneath Barazinbar for Mithril, the metal beyond price that was becoming yearly ever harder to win. Thus they roused from sleep a thing of terror that, flying from Thangorodrim, had lain hidden at the foundations of the earth since the coming of the host of the West, a Balrog of Morgoth. Or perhaps they released it from prison. It may well be that it had already been awakened by the malice of Sauron. Durin was slain by it, and the year after, Nine the First, his son. And then the glory of Moria passed, and its people were destroyed or fled far away. Most of those that escaped made their way into the north, and Thrain the First, Nine's son, came to Erebor, the lonely mountain, near the eastern eaves of Mirkwood, and there he began new works, and became king under the mountain. In Erebor he found the great jewel, the Arkenstone, heart of the mountain. But Thorin the First, his son, removed and went into the far north to the grey mountains, where most of Durin's folk were now gathering, for those mountains were rich and little explored. But there were dragons in the wastes beyond, and after many years they became strong again and multiplied, and they made war on the dwarves and plundered their works. At last Dain the First, together with Fror, his second son, was slain at the doors of his hall by a great cold drake. Not long after most of Durin's folk abandoned the grey mountains, Gror, Dain's son, went away with many followers to the Iron Hills, but Thror, Dain's heir, with Borin, his father's brother, and the remainder of the people, returned to Erebor. To the great hall of Thrain, Thror brought back the Arkenstone, and he and his folk prospered and became rich, and they had the friendship of all men that dwelt near. For they made not only things of wonder and beauty, but weapons and armour of great worth, and there was great traffic of ore between them and their kin in the Iron Hills. Thus the Northmen who lived between Kelduin, River Running, and Carnen, Red Water, became strong and drove back all enemies from the east, and the dwarves lived in plenty, and there was feasting and song in the halls of Erebor. So the rumour of the wealth of Erebor spread abroad and reached the ears of the dragons. And at last Smaug the Golden, greatest of the dragons of his day, arose and without warning came against King Thror and descended on the mountain in flames. It was not long before all that realm was destroyed, and the town of Dale nearby was ruined and deserted. But Smaug entered into the great hall, and lay there upon a bed of gold. From the sack and the burning many of Thror's kin escaped, and last of all from the halls by a secret door came Thror himself and his son Thrain the Second. They went away south, into long and homeless wandering, with their family, among whom were the children of Thrain the Second, Thorin Oakenshield, Freyrin, and Dis. Thorin was then a youngster in the reckoning of the dwarves. With them went also a small company of their kinsmen and faithful followers. It was afterwards learned that more of the folk under the mountain had escaped than was at first hoped, but most of these went to the Iron Hills. Years afterwards Thror, now old, poor, and desperate, gave to his son Thrain the one great treasure he still possessed, the last of the Seven Rings, and then he went away with one old companion only, called Nar. Of the ring he said to Thrain at their parting,
"This may prove the foundation of new fortune for you yet, though that seems unlikely, but it needs gold to breed gold. Surely you do not think of returning to Erebor?" said Thrain.
"Not at my age," said Thror.
Our vengeance on Smaug I bequeath to you and your sons. But I'm tired of poverty and the scorn of men. I go to see what I can find.
He did not say where. He was a little crazed, perhaps, with age and misfortune, and long brooding on the splendour of Moria in his forefathers' days. Or the ring, it may be, was turned to evil now that its master was awake, driving him to folly and destruction. From Dunland, where he was then dwelling, he went north with Nar, and they crossed the Redhorn Pass, and came down into Azan-ul-Zibar. When Thror came to Moria, the gate was open. Nar begged him to beware, but he took no heed of him, and walked proudly in as an heir that returns. But he did not come back. Nar stayed nearby for many days in hiding. One day he heard a loud shout and the blare of a horn, and a body was flung out on the steps. Fearing that it was Thror, he began to creep near. But there came a voice from within the gate.
"Come on, beardling, we can see you, but there's no need to be afraid today. We need you as a messenger."
Then Nar came up, and found that it was indeed the body of Thror, but the head was severed and lay face downwards. As he knelt there, he heard orc laughter in the shadows, and the voice said,
"If beggars will not wait at the door, but sneak in to try thieving, that's what we do to them. If any of your people poke their foul beards in here again, they will fare the same. Go and tell them so. But if his family wish to know who is now king here, the name is written on his face. I wrote it. I killed him. I am the master."
Then Nar turned the head, and saw, branded on the brow in dwarf runes, so that he could read it, the name Azog. That name was branded in his heart, and in the hearts of all the dwarves afterwards. Nar stooped to take the head, but the voice of Azog said,
"Drop it. Be off. Here's your fee, beggar beard."
A small bag struck him. It held a few coins of little worth. Weeping, Nar fled down the silver load, but he looked back once and saw that orcs had come from the gate and were hacking up the body and flinging the pieces to the black crows. Such was the tale that Nar brought back to Thrain, and when he had wept and torn his beard, he fell silent. 7 days he sat and said no word. Then he stood up and said,
"This cannot be borne."
That was the beginning of the war of the dwarves and the orcs, which was long and deadly, and fought for the most part in deep places beneath the earth. Thrain at once sent messengers bearing the tale north, east, and west, but it was 3 years before the dwarves had mustered their strength.
Durin's folk gathered all their host, and they were joined by great forces sent from the houses of the other fathers. For this dishonour to the heir of the eldest of their race filled them with wrath. When all was ready, they assailed and sacked, one by one, all the strongholds of the orcs that they could, from Gundabad to the Gladden. Both sides were pitiless, and there was death and cruel deeds by dark and by light. But the dwarves had the victory through their strength, and their matchless weapons, and the fire of their anger, as they hunted for Azog in every den under mountain. At last all the orcs that fled before them were gathered in Moria, and the dwarf host, in pursuit, came to Azan-ul-Bizar. That was a great vale that lay between the arms of the mountains about the lake of Hel-ed-Zaram, and had been of old part of the kingdom of Hazard-Dûm. When the dwarves saw the gate of their ancient mansions upon the hillside, they sent up a great shout like thunder in the valley. But a great host of foes was arrayed on the slopes above them, and out of the gates poured a multitude of orcs that had been held back by Azog for the last need. At first fortune was against the dwarves, for it was a dark day of winter without sun, and the orcs did not waver, and they outnumbered their enemies, and had the higher ground. So began the battle of Azan-ul-Bizar, or Nandohirion in the Elvish tongue.
at the memory of which the orcs still shudder and the dwarves weep. The first assault of the vanguard, led by Thryne, was thrown back with loss, and Thryne was driven into a wood of great trees that then still grew not far from Kaled Zarum. There Freyrin his son fell, and Fundin his kinsman, and many others, and both Thryne and Thorin were wounded. Elsewhere the battle swayed to and fro with great slaughter, until at last the people of the Iron Hills turned the day. Coming late and fresh to the field, the mailed warriors of Nine, Gror's son, drove through the orcs to the very threshold of Moria, crying, "Azog! Azog!" as they hewed down with their mattocks all who stood in their way. It is said that Thorin's shield was cloven, and he cast it away, and he hewed off with his axe a branch of an oak, and held it in his left hand to ward off the strokes of his foes, or to wield as a club. In this way he got his name. Then Nine stood before the gate, and cried with a great voice,
"Azog, if you are in, come out, or is the play in the valley too rough?"
Thereupon Azog came forth, and he was a great orc with a huge iron-clad head, and yet agile and strong. With him came many like him, the fighters of his guard, and as they engaged Nine's company, he turned to Nine and said,
"What? Yet another beggar at my doors? Must I brand you too?"
With that he rushed at Nine, and they fought. But Nine was half blind with rage, and also very weary with battle, whereas Azog was fresh and fell, and full of guile. Soon Nine made a great stroke with all his strength that remained, but Azog darted aside and kicked Nine's leg, so that the mattock splintered on the stone where he had stood. But Nine stumbled forward. Then Azog, with a swift swing, hewed his neck. His mail collar withstood the edge, but so heavy was the blow that Nine's neck was broken, and he fell. Then Azog laughed, and he lifted up his head to let forth a great yell of triumph, but the cry died in his throat. For he saw that all his host in the valley was in a rout, and the dwarves went this way and that, slaying as they would, and those that could escape from them were flying south, shrieking as they ran, and hard by all the soldiers of his guard lay dead. He turned and fled backwards towards the gate. Up the steps after him leapt a dwarf with a red axe. It was Dain Ironfoot, Nine's son. Right before the doors he caught Azog, and there he slew him and hewed off his head. That was held a great feat, for Dain was then only a stripling in the reckoning of the dwarves. But long life and many battles lay before him, until old but unbowed he fell at last in the War of the Ring. Yet hardy and full of wrath as he was, it is said that when he came down from the gate he looked grey in the face, as one who has felt great fear. When at last the battle was won, the dwarves that were left gathered in Azanulbizar. They took the head of Azog, and thrust into its mouth the purse of small money, and then they set it on a stake. But no feast nor song was there that night, for their dead were beyond the count of grief. Barely half of their number, it is said, could still stand or had hope of healing. Nonetheless, in the morning Thryne stood before them. He had one eye blinded beyond cure, and he was halt with a leg wound, but he said,
"Good, we have won the victory. Khazad Dûm is ours."
But they answered, "Durin's heir you may be, but even with one eye you should see clearer. We fought this war for vengeance, and vengeance we have taken, but it is not sweet. If this is victory, then our hands are too small to hold it." And those who were not of Durin's folk said also, "Khazad Dûm was not our father's house. What is it to us, unless a hope of treasure? But now, if we must go without the rewards and the weir-guilds that are owed to us, the sooner we return to our own lands, the better pleased we shall be." Then Thryne turned to Dain and said,
"But surely my own kin will not desert me?"
"No," said Dain, "you are the father of our folk, and we have bled for you, and will again. But we will not enter Khazad Dûm. You will not enter Khazad Dûm.
Only I have looked through the shadow of the gate. Beyond the shadow, it waits for you still, Durin's Bane. The world must change, and some other power than ours must come before Durin's folk walk again in Moria. So it was that after Azanulbizar, the dwarves dispersed again. But first with great labour they stripped